In just a few weeks, $10 billion will land in Northern Ontario, but how it will be dispersed among the thousands of Robinson-Huron Treaty members is causing confusion, concern and even anger among some members of the 21 signatory First Nation communities. As the settlement amount from the Robinson-Huron Treaty annuities claim is divided amongst each First Nation, members are being asked to vote on how much will be given to each individual person, and how much will be kept by the band. That, and many nations are discussing a sliding scale individual payment, with more going to elders, who lost more over the course of their lives, and less to young people. There is also concern about the perceived lack of benefits to those living off reserve, which accounts for upwards of 80% of the population of some nations. As the payments come closer to fruition, members of five of the 21 nations have come to Sudbury.com with complaints that their choices are limited and lack transparency. They said they feel like their concerns, ranging from disagreement with the allotment of the $10 billion settlement to a deep mistrust with their respective chiefs and councillors, are dismissed or ignored. A map showing the area of the Robinson-Huron Treaty of 1850. Supplied. As well, the documents show the payments are not uniform for all signatory members. Some larger First Nations will receive smaller amounts of around $5,000 per person. Others, like Thessalon First Nation, could see payments as large as $100,000, sources tell Sudbury.com. The members Sudbury.com spoke to said they are being asked to register an important vote on the percentages very soon, without fair questions, or a complete understanding of what they are being asked to do. The complaints could be seen as similar to those uncovered by the Office of the Mizginawi, hired to do the first round of consultations. The office was closed almost 5 months ago. In order to better understand these issues, Sudbury.com went in search of the original documents that laid out the claim, which until now, have not been made public. Several of the concerned band members who reached out to and spoke with Sudbury.com shared the documents with us. Sudbury.com is not naming any of the people who trusted us with the material, but we have confirmed their identities as band members. Laid out by the RHTLF in 2010, and heretofore protected by privilege, the legal documents, trust indenture and CDA, spell out the early years of the claim, and the plan for any proceeds from it. The RHTLF is still dealing with percentages until the settlement is finalized and can't speak to exact amounts yet. But the common refrain among each person Sudbury.com spoke with was a wish for more control, more information, and less secrecy. The answers begin by following the path that led to the 2023 settlement, which began in 2010. What is the trust indenture? In the early to mid-2000s, and certainly before, the Lake Huron First Nations, aka the 21 signatories of the treaty, believed they were entitled to higher annuity payments under the Robinson-Huron Treaty of 1850. They established a trust in order to pursue that claim in court, with each nation becoming settlers of the trust and then naming trustees to represent them. The members of each nation became beneficiaries under the contract. The claim involved a clause in the Treaty of 1850, in which the Crown promised to make an annual payment of £600, $2,400, to members of the Treaty First Nations. In 1850, that worked out to approximately $1.60 per person. However, the Crown provided an additional incentive for the Anishinaabeg communities to sign the treaty, called an augmentation clause. This clause meant if further wealth was generated in the territory in future years, the Crown was obligated to increase the annuity. The one and only time the annuity was increased was in 1874, when the government augmented it to $4 per person. It remains $4 per person today, despite the billions in dollars of resource wealth extracted from signatory territories over the past more than 100 years. The trust allowed the First Nations to submit a claim against the Crown for unfulfilled obligations. The advocating body was created under a trust, signed August 23, 2010. The trust is between the First Nation, settlers of the trust, and their named trustees, of which there are 22. From there, the trust required the creation of the Litigation Management Committee, LMC, made up of two trustees per subregion, Manitoulin Island, North Shore and the Highway 69 Corridor subregions. The LMC guides the legal team, Nawegabau Corbière, and the other trustees. The members of the LMC are Mike Restoul, Chief Patsy Corbière, Ondek Omni Conning, Duke Peltier, Wikwamikung, Peter Ricolet, Wanapite, Dean Sayers, Batchawana, and Ogama Angus Toulouse, Sagamok. Both Peltier and Sayers are former chiefs voted out within the last 2 years. The LMC was to create a business plan for the first year and first 5 years of the claim as set out in the trust, and file annual reports. The trust was named the Robinson-Huron Treaty Litigation Fund, RHTLF. It was the RHTLF that filed the annuities statement of claim in 2012. Stage 1 of the trial began with opening statement September 25, 2017. In 2018, Justice Patricia Hennessy ruled that by not increasing annuities payments as the mining and forestry resource sectors grew, the Crown and province had not lived up to the terms of the treaty. She ruled that the Crown had a mandatory and reviewable constitutional obligation to increase the annuity to reflect the economic value the Crown receives from the treaty territory. After several appeals by the provincial government, a $10 billion settlement was announced in 2023, covering what should have been given as annuities from 1874 to 2023. The future payments are yet to be determined. From this point, there will be further action regarding the amounts of future annual payments under the treaty, but for now, the $4 payment remains the same. This was also a point of confusion for many who spoke with Sudbury.com, and on social media. The trust indenture also sets out how funds generated by the claim would be distributed to the First Nation members, called the Collective Disbursement Agreement, CDA. On multiple occasions, the trust indenture notes that the entitlement to annuities under the Robinson-Huron Treaty are treaty rights, and as such, they are not individual rights, they are collective rights. This collective versus individual division of the funds is the focus of the disbursement agreement, and also, the issues that many have with RHTLF's handling of the settlement payout. The trust's collective disbursement agreement. The trust indenture sets how any potential sums received would be divided, and makes clear that the agreement should be governed by our own Anishinaabeg customs, laws and history, as well as the spirit and intent of the treaty, and not by the Indian Act or Indian Affairs policies, treaty pay lists or membership lists. There are three payments set out in the Compensation Disbursement Agreement, CDA. The first priority payment is allocated to legal fees and other costs, as well as a 25% return on the original investments by each nation when the trust was created. The CDA sets out the next two priority payments, each 50% of the remaining proceeds. The second priority payment will see 39% of the claim proceeds distributed equally among the First Nations that participated in the trust, with 1% going to living individual annuitants who are not members of a Lake Huron First Nation, such as those who faced enfranchisement. From there, 10% is to be set aside, for collective purposes of advancing rights and interests of the First Nations who participated in the trust. The third priority payment is divided, 25% for First Nations who participated in the trust proportionate to respective population, subject to verification process, and 25% of proceeds going to First Nations, who participated in the trust proportionate to the number of annuitants within respective populations. When the settlement was announced on June 17, 2023, the RHTLF created the Office of the Mizginawi and hired Justice Harry S. Laforme to lead it. Created according to Anishinaabe law, the Mizginawi, Mij in a way, was a traditional role in place when the treaty was signed in 1850. The meaning is similar to near chief. In the terms of reference set out for the role of Mizginawi, Laforme was to examine issues and engage in consultations with the RHT members and provide advice on the use and distribution of the compensation to be paid by the Crown, subject to the terms of the CDA, the priority payments. La Forme was to work at the direction of the LMC, but act independently of it, and to ensure, in particular, that Anishinaabe laws and protocols are respected and adhered to. After an initial round of consultations with the First Nation Inuitants, La Forme produced an interim report. After it was received by the RHTLF, La Forme was either fired, or resigned from the position. It is still unclear. Sudbury.com was able to obtain a copy of the privileged report from the office of the Mizginawi, and you can find the full details of it here. In addition to asking for more notice of the meeting dates and more time to digest the information given before offering input, the interim report states, it is also clear that more engagement and communication is necessary to clarify issues for community members. There were numerous requests for more in-person gatherings, said the report, as well as outreach to youth and elders. Many participants requested copies of the information given to them, and questioned why more details weren't available. There was also a quote about the faith in current leadership. In some communities, some were openly distrustful of the chief and council or questioned the role of the LMC. The report states some found the legal presentation on the settlement agreement and existing CDA difficult or impossible to understand. In almost every community, there were questions about the specific costs of legal and other professional services incurred by the RHTLF and a clear expectation that members of First Nations are entitled to this information. It appears that many community members do not understand the rationale and mechanics of the distribution formula, reads the report. Accordingly, continued efforts to explain the distribution formula by the RHTLF and LMC are necessary in future sessions. There are also questions about who is a treaty member. Members in just about every community also have expressed concern about the arbitrariness of aspects of imposed federal law respecting Indian status and how that has been used to determine treaty beneficiary status for the purposes of paying the current Crown-controlled $4 annuity. Sudbury.com sources noted that since the closure of the office of the Mizginawi, the individual First Nations have been conducting information sessions, but there appear to be inconsistencies in the number of meetings being held, whether they are in person, virtual or hybrid, and the amount of information shared by each. This is confirmed by event listings on individual First Nations social media accounts. Though we have been unable to verify, two RHT members have shared with Sudbury.com that they have been limited from accessing these meetings. But from the information shared and interviews conducted by Sudbury.com with RHT members, the complaints appear to be the same as they were in La Forme's interim report, and each community's opportunity to discuss the matter is limited by the legal privilege surrounding the settlement. Justice Harry S. La Forme, Anishinaabe from the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation, will lead the office of the Mizginawi for the Robinson-Huron Treaty Litigation Fund. Supplied. Some say the sliding age scale for payments is depriving the youth of a chance to invest in their future. One suggested it was a way to prevent overspending by youth, especially those who are addicted to substances. A primary issue raised by those who spoke to Sudbury.com is the investment into First Nations where a majority of their population lives off reserve. One RHT member told Sudbury.com that in their recent chief and council elections, a lot of off-reserve members did not receive voting ballots in the mail, despite updating their addresses. They said this has caused the First Nation to distrust their leadership. At least three RHT First Nations had sweeping changes to their councils after recent elections. There are also a few First Nations with ongoing land claims. Two of the sources Sudbury.com spoke with said they do not wish to contribute so much to the community chest, and would prefer larger individual payouts as the money from these claims could provide future investment money. An RHT member told Sudbury.com they feel their leadership already limits spending, citing favoritism, and feels this trend will continue with any settlement monies received. The settlement disbursement looms. When more than 60 people came together February 26 with the Nipissing grandmothers to call attention to their pleas for more information, Nipissing First Nation Chief Scott McLeod noted to Sudbury.com sister publication, Beta Day, that, since members have directly received the $4 annual payment for well over a century, they feel that the compensation is 100% theirs, and somehow we are taking money from them, for the proposed community fund. When in fact, he continued, if they understood the treaty, how it was written, what our legal arguments were, and how that decision was upheld in court, they would understand that the treaty itself was not merely an individual payment. Rather, MacLeod explained, it was a communal payment to a nation that first started in 1850 as a lump sum to the chiefs. This payment took care of the communal needs at that time, he continued, the rest was dispersed to the individual, which became the $4 payment. This was how the original payment structure went, MacLeod said. However, shortly after the Crown implemented the treaty, the government decided this was too costly and they were going to administer payments instead of giving it to the chiefs, and allowing them to administer the funds. Regardless of this history, the members Sudbury.com spoke with say they feel they do not have enough information to make an informed choice, and they are concerned about the power over the money that chief and council have. They are deeply concerned for the future of their communities, and the lack of agency they feel throughout the process could mean a deep rift, and one that $10 billion may not fix. Jenny Lamoth covers the diverse communities of Sudbury, especially the vulnerable or marginalized, including the Black, Indigenous, Newcomer and Francophone communities, as well as two SLGBTQ+ and the downtown core.